Welcome back to the program. There's an old saying that goes, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. When we look at U.S. foreign and military policy since Vietnam, truly shame on us. But why? In Vietnam, the best and the brightest led us into disaster. In Iraq, the mistakes and miscalculations of the previous administration cost us dearly in lives and treasure. In the early days of the Obama administration, the decision to surge troops into Afghanistan was equally ill-timed, ill-conceived, and once again showed how intelligence and politics, even when linked with good intentions, can lead us into a disastrous situation. Our guest today, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, brilliantly showed us what happened in Iraq in his award-winning book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City. Now he takes us inside the decisions that led to the surge in Afghanistan in 2009-2010. Rajiv Chandrasekaran is a senior correspondent and associate editor of the Washington Post. He's been the newspaper's bureau chief in Baghdad, Cairo, and Southeast Asia, and he's been covering Afghanistan on and off for over a decade. It is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about his new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Rajiv Chandrasekaran, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Good to be on with you.
It's great to have you here. Why do we always seem to get it wrong? When we look at the best and the brightest in Vietnam, when we look at what you wrote about in terms of our actions in Iraq, in Imperial Life in the Emerald City, and now looking at Afghanistan, we have good intentions, we have smart people, and somehow it seems to go awry.
Well, I guess we Americans are an optimistic people who think that, well, you know, we can turn this around, despite the challenges that seem, quite frankly, insurmountable. You know, Neil Sheehan, the great journalist and historian who covered the Vietnam War, wrote a review of my book in the Washington Post over the weekend where he noted that Americans think of themselves as a historyless people, and we're not. Yet we seem to go into decisions like this without fully grasping the lessons of the past. And anybody who bothered to look, for instance, at the lessons of the Vietnam War in the discussions about a surge in Afghanistan would have come away perhaps with a different recommendation. Yet the one individual, the Obama administration, Richard Holbrooke, the late veteran diplomat, who had served in Vietnam and tried to raise some of those parallels, was quickly shot down by members of the new president's national security team. It's a group of smart people there in the White House, but they don't have the perspective of having run a war before, and I think they believed that with the right resources, with the right focus, with the right strategy, they could reverse the years of strategic drift in Afghanistan that existed during the Bush presidency. But Afghanistan is far more complicated than that. And I think that, you know, we went, unfortunately, from some years of starving the country from resources. And much has been said about had we not taken our eye off the ball in Afghanistan to focus on going into Iraq and instead tried to get Afghanistan right in those early years after the 9/11 attack, we'd be in a very, very different place today. And I think the Obama administration felt that if they simply did what should have been done in the early years of the war, that they could get to a good enough place. But, what we've seen so painfully is that in those intervening years, so much scar tissue had built up that Afghanistan really resisted meaningful change with additional resources put in. And quite frankly, we then, and we can talk more about this, in my view, wound up trying to jam too much down the throats of the Afghans too quickly, too many troops, too many dollars. And we swung the pendulum from one extreme to the other when perhaps what we should have done was focused on more modest, sustainable initiatives.
And in trying to determine what should be done in that 2009-2010 period, one of the ironies that I came away with was that the civilians inside the White House, the civilians within the administration, were the ones that were gung-ho for a more counterterrorism approach, and it was, in fact, the military that was pushing the counterinsurgency approach.
Yeah, this is a great irony. You go back 20 years, right? It was it was the civilians who wanted to do grand things, and the military that said, look, our goals need to be narrow. We need to be, you know, well-defined here. Things have sort of flipped on their heads. And in part, it's because of misreading of what occurred in Iraq. The military was convinced that by surging more forces and implementing a counterinsurgency strategy, which essentially means you use the bulk of your forces to try to protect the good people from the bad people, that they could turn a situation around, regardless of where it was, and that they could build new governments, provide basic services, do all of the stuff that was necessary to defeat a persistent dug-in insurgency. The truth is, the changes in Iraq were due to a host of factors. It was far more complex than the military had reduced it down to. And they weren't really building a new government there. Iraq, with its ample oil resources and human capacity, I mean, they have a lot of people who can read and write and have college degrees. The Iraqis really built their new government for themselves. Well, the problem was in Afghanistan, they felt that they could do all of this from scratch. And Afghanistan is, in many places, it's still sort of stuck in the 13th century, and you have vast swaths of the country where most people can't read and write. You don't have a real functioning government. And perhaps the most significant reason was that the Afghan people themselves don't really want to be connected to their government in many cases. It's not that they have any great love for the Taliban. They see them as a bunch of religious zealots. But they look at their own government and say, these are a bunch of, you know, corrupt scoundrels. They steal from us. They abuse us. They kidnap young boys for pleasure. These are not the sorts of people that we want running our affairs. And so when American troops came in and said, we're here to protect you and we're here to bring your government to you, many of them sort of said to themselves, whoa, we don't want that. And we failed to grasp some of those very, very basic dynamics of Afghanistan. And led by these very ambitious military commanders, General David Petraeus, General Stan McChrystal, among others, felt that more American force plus American resources to help with reconstruction and development and governance could bring goodness, and that would somehow get the place back up on its feet. Noble intentions, of course, but not necessarily in keeping with how the Afghan people saw the situation, saw the relationship with their government, saw their future.
And yet, another one of the ironies is that two of the people within the administration, and you alluded to one of them, that had the greatest depth and range of experience, Vice President Joe Biden and Richard Holbrooke, both advocated strongly against this strategy of counterinsurgency.
That's right. Although, truth be told, Jeff, Holbrooke kind of hung back a little bit because his boss, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, was actually pretty hawkish in these discussions and felt that a troop surge was warranted. And since Clinton was his only protector, he couldn't really get out in front of her and speak his mind, even though he believed privately, and he told close associates that he thought the surge was a mistake. Joe Biden, former chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, felt that sending more forces there would be a big mistake. Carl Eikenberry, the U.S. ambassador to Kabul at the time, felt the same way, as did many of the president's other civilian advisors in the White House, on the National Security Council and in the West Wing. And they noted that, they argued that President Hamid Karzai was not an adequate strategic partner, that the sanctuaries in Pakistan that the Taliban enjoyed would continue to bedevil efforts to stabilize the country. That the Afghan army was in no position to start to take control of areas that were going to be cleared by U.S. forces, often at the cost of American lives and limbs. And they argued that what was perhaps would be more effective would be a narrower strategy focused simply on going after big fish Taliban leaders and al-Qaeda leaders, who were the real targets of the war effort, since the American the key goals of the American war were really to go after and defeat and dismantle al-Qaeda, not to build a brand new Jeffersonian democracy in Afghanistan. Yet their views were essentially not disregarded, but they did not win the day, ultimately. You had President Obama, who I think very much appreciated those inputs. And, you know, it's impossible to see inside his head, but people who work closely with him believe that he was actually very sympathetic to those views. But here was a first-term young Democratic president who he campaigned on Iraq being the bad war and implicitly Afghanistan being the good war, and promised that he would increase resources in Afghanistan, and perhaps felt that he could not essentially turn back on those campaign pledges, even though what the military was asking for was far more than he perhaps felt comfortable ponying up to them. It was a close decision, but ultimately the military got much of what it wanted. Though when we look back now, in hindsight, we see that the concerns raised by Biden, by Eikenberry, by others on his team, the civilians, were spot on. Karzai's government is corrupt and is not a strategic partner and never believed in the counterinsurgency strategy. Pakistan has done precious little to crack down on these sanctuaries. And the list goes on. And by the way, some of the greatest gains that have been achieved against the Taliban militarily have been the result of nighttime raids and other actions taken by special forces. The very sort of counterterrorism model advocated by Biden, as opposed to the big footprint conventional force counterinsurgency mission.
The other overlay to all this is that once the decision was made to pursue this strategy of counterinsurgency, that it was executed so badly.
Yes, and you've honed in on a key point in my book. You know, I argue this at two levels. One was the strategic issue, which is what we've just talked about. But then, accept that the president did approve a counterinsurgency strategy, did authorize more forces. So then you say, how was that carried out? And what I found from reporting on the ground in Afghanistan, making more than a dozen trips over 2.5 years, and a lot of reporting back in Washington, was that the execution of this strategy, of the surge, was deeply flawed in several key ways. The first was the Pentagon sent the first waves of new forces to the wrong places. You would expect that if our strategy was supposed to be counterinsurgency, protecting the people, we would send the bulk of our new forces to key population centers to protect them against Taliban advances. Instead, we sent the bulk of that first wave of a very talented group of U.S. Marines off to a part of the southern desert that was home to less than 1% of the country's population. Why, you may ask? It was because of tribal politics, not in Afghanistan, but at the Pentagon. The Marine Corps didn't want to work side by side with the U.S. and Canadian armies in Kandahar, the country's second largest city. They essentially demanded their own patch of the sandbox that they could be in by themselves, and the only place they could be carved out and given to them was a far less strategically relevant part of the country. Another way we mucked it up, the civilian surge. We were supposed to have a surge of diplomats and reconstruction workers that was supposed to unfold in tandem with the military surge. The problem? That civilian surge unfolded too slowly. Most of the civilians were kept in Kabul, in the capital, as opposed to being pushed out into the provinces and districts where those new troops were operating. And then on the reconstruction front, we wound up essentially going from a period of time where we put in too little money to Afghanistan to a period of time where we put too much in. In 2010, we tried to spend $4 billion on reconstruction projects there. It flooded the country with way more money than it could reasonably absorb, fueling the very corruption we were trying to cut back on. And the fourth key issue that I write about in Little America, about how we sort of mucked up the operations of the surge and the strategy, was this really nasty, vicious infighting in Washington with an individual that we've talked about just a second. going to go, Richard Holbrooke. He was brought in by Hillary Clinton to be the administration's point man for Afghanistan, and a man with vast experience. I mean, he served in Vietnam at age 27, was the youngest American to participate in the Paris peace talks aimed at ending that war. In 1996, he brokered the Dayton Accords that ended fighting in the Balkans. This was a man with more experience with war and peace than anybody else in the administration. Yet, and his job was to try to see if there was a path to getting to negotiations with the Taliban, trying to find a way to end this war at the negotiating table, or at least to reduce the scope of the conflict by peeling off certain Taliban factions. This was an effort that was the broader effort of trying to find peace was something the White House wanted, but many members of the president's team just didn't like Holbrooke. It was a personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
They just thought he was an egotist. They didn't get along with him. And so instead of working in concert to try to achieve this goal, they wound up spending a bulk of their time fighting with him. It was just sort of this nasty, petty infighting. And you just expect better from senior officials in Washington that they should sort of get over these internal issues and focus on executing the policy as opposed to trying to one-up one another within the hallways of the White House and the State Department.
One of the other aspects that we seem to get so wrong is this need for a quick solution. Kyle Weston, who's a Foreign Service officer and one of the key characters in your book, talks about this whole notion of really understanding that this is a marathon, not a sprint, and we never seem to get that.
Yes, you know, we think that if we simply pour in more resources, we can achieve the hoped-for outcome sooner. And Afghanistan doesn't work that way. Afghanistan is a place where, you know, slow and steady wins the race, if there is a race to be won. It's not a place where you can expect overnight turnarounds. And so what the Afghan people wanted was help from the United States. You know, when we see these television images of people rioting on the streets there, you come away with the sense, perhaps, that the Afghans hate the Americans. And that couldn't be further from the truth. They do want international assistance. And I also believe that it would simply be wrong to pack up entirely and leave. I think that we have a moral obligation to the Afghan people. We implicitly promised them that if they sided with us against the Taliban in 2001, they would have a shot at a better, freer life. But that doesn't necessarily mean we need to have tens and tens of thousands of troops there or pouring in as many resources as we are. What the Afghans need is a commitment from the United States and its international partners that we will be there to help them build a reasonably stable new country, but that the hard work really has to be theirs, that we'll support them, but they have to do it. Instead, by sending in so many more resources, we essentially provided a crutch to them. The message was, you don't have to do the fighting. We're here to do the fighting for you. You don't have to find a way to pay the bills because we're paying for all of it. In fact, you know, it had sort of the opposite outcome from what we wanted.
It's interesting that as strategy changed in 2010 very subtly and became more of a counterterrorism strategy, that not only was there more success in the mission, but there was more acceptance even from the Karzai government.
Yes, because the Karzai government didn't really believe in counterinsurgency. He thought that with U.S. troops going out there in valleys and villages in southern and eastern Afghanistan, we were mucking up what was a self-regulating system of ethnic Pashtun governance. And Hamid Karzai saw it as a threat to his power base, that we were going to sideline various power brokers and chieftains who were allies of his. Now, admittedly, those guys were corrupt, but if you want to sideline them, you have to be ready then to spend 10, 20 years building government from scratch. And that's certainly not something that the American people have the stomach for. And at this point in the war, which has now been going on for more than a decade, even the Afghan people don't want us sticking around for 20 years to try to rebuild their government, even though they hate the government that they have. And so this change really has to be brought on by the Afghans as opposed to the United States going in and picking winners and losers, even if we look at some of these guys and find them to be thoroughly detestable figures. I have a chapter about a warlord that essentially runs a key border crossing area in southern Afghanistan, and we wanted to push him aside, and then we realized that we needed him to help ensure the safety of goods coming in to support the troops, and so we then started to embrace him. We tried to mentor him. He's still a deeply troubled figure who engages in extrajudicial killings and is involved in rampant drug smuggling, among other things. But, you know, he's going to be up to the Afghans to deal with. If we pushed him aside, who would fill that vacuum? Do we know who's better? And in most places, I would argue that we don't. We can identify guys as bad guys, but we don't necessarily know who are all the good guys. In places where we've tried to embrace people as sort of local saviors and local good guys, we've then discovered, you know, a year or two later that those guys were in some ways just as bad. They were just engaged in different forms of corruption or misbehavior that we didn't necessarily see up front.
At what point, or if at all, did the military leaders, that people like McChrystal and Petraeus, realize that the execution was going so badly?
I don't believe they ever did. I think that they believed that this was going relatively well, at least from a military point of view. Yes, they were critical of the civilian surge and thought that was a big problem. And in truth be told, they did privately question, for instance, the deployment of so many Marines to Helmand, where there weren't a whole lot of people. But by and large, they stick to their story that the counterinsurgency mission is working, in part because they define counterinsurgency very broadly. So even though it is this narrow subset of activities that would be more appropriately called counterterrorism, the stuff that Joe Biden was advocating, They claim that counterinsurgency also includes that. But General Petraeus had this PowerPoint slide that listed all of the elements of his strategy, and it had several dozen separate things that were to be done. I write in the book that it looked like he was espousing the use of every sort of military tactic in the book to be called counterinsurgency, save for the use of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the decision that was later made by the Obama administration to really bring troops home in September of 2012, and what that added to these problems.
That's a very good question. So when the president decided to surge back in late 2009, he announced that come the summer of 2011, he would start to bring troops home. And so last summer, there was a series of high-level meetings at the White House to determine, okay, what's the pace of the drawdown of forces? And, of course, once again, the military argued that they should keep as many forces there for as long as possible. Petraeus really wanted to push the drawdown as far into the future as possible. Biden and the civilian advisors argued that the counterinsurgency mission wasn't working, that Karzai was not a partner, and as such, we should bring troops home relatively quickly. In the end, the president opted for a middle ground solution. But this time, it's worth noting, he did not give the commanders everything that they wanted. But in doing so, the president has essentially argued to the American people, and still argues to the American people, that the surge has been a relative success. And this is just basic politics. He cannot say, oh, my guys were right in arguing that the surge wasn't really going to work. I told you so. So instead, he has to sort of say, my decision to send more forces helped to improve the situation in Afghanistan, and as such, I can start bringing forces home. But White House officials recognize this is a narrative for public consumption. At the end of the book, I quote a senior official saying to me that, you know, they know that the surge didn't work, but they can't say that. Last summer, the CIA conducted an assessment done district by district. Afghanistan has 400 districts, and they examined all of them. And they found that the surge really had not, in an overall way, improved security. Yes, it had in some places, but in other places, security had deteriorated. Overall, it had been a wash. The White House did not ask for that report before making a decision about the troop drawdown, in part because they didn't want it to be seen as the decision being based on things not going well there, even if that was the truth. What they wanted was to say things are going well, so that's why we're pulling troops out.
How much was U.S. policy in Afghanistan through this surge, the period we've been talking about, how much was it informed at all by the Iraq experience?
Oh, I think deeply, particularly for the military, which believed that they had turned around Iraq, so as a result, they could turn around Afghanistan in the same way.
Talk a little bit about the administration and the civilians within the administration. Did they ever realize that mistakes had been made? We talked about the military.
Yes. Civilians within the administration did come to see these shortcomings, but they were ultimately the losers in the policy process. And so while they sought to raise concern about this, again and again, once those troops were authorized and once the strategy was, you know, starting to be implemented, there was little they could do to sort of then pull it back. They had to wait for it to take its course, to go at least through the president's July 11 deadline, and then start to bring troops home. But it does pose a grave moral question for those who believe that this wasn't going to work, and perhaps saw the surge as a way to eventually exit. How do you justify or explain the lives of those who've been lost and those who've been gravely wounded if your troop surge was just a way to get to the exit?
And have we learned anything from this? Has the military, do you think, learned anything from this experience?
Oh, yes. I think now the military, at least junior officers, are far more skeptical of counterinsurgency. They're more chastened. I think the senior officer ranks, those who had been so vocally supportive of counterinsurgency, remain so because their reputations depend on it. But those who are younger, who are out in the field, who were at risk of getting shot and blown up, they see the real limitations. And they also, I think, understand the cost-benefit. Now, these are young men and women who are out there who, you know, are in environments where we're disbursing millions of dollars to build new roads and bridges and schools in Afghanistan. And then they come home to their communities in the United States and discover that their kids' after-school programs have been cut and there are potholes on the streets because we don't have the money to fix our infrastructure over here. And many of them are questioning the allocation of resources. You know, we spend more to station Marine battalions in two districts in southern Afghanistan where everybody lives in mud brick huts and there's no electricity or running water than we provided last year to the entire nation of Egypt in military and non-military aid. Now, here you have this massive country undergoing this hoped-for democratic transition, a key American ally in the Middle East, and yet we are spending a fraction of the money trying to sort of build more stable systems and assist people there compared to what we're doing in parts of Afghanistan that are thoroughly disconnected from the modern world.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, the book is Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Rajiv, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
A real pleasure to talk to you this morning, Jeff.
Thank you.